On July 16, 1923, I moved into Exham Priory after the last workman had finished his labors. The restoration had been a stupendous task, for little had remained of the deserted pile but a shell-like ruin. Yet because it had been the seat of my ancestors, I let no expense deter me. The place had not been inhabited since the reign of James I, when a tragedy of intensely hideous, though largely unexplained nature, had struck down the master, five of his children, and several servants, and driven forth under a cloud of suspicion and terror the third son, my lineal progenitor, and the only survivor of the abhorred line. With this sole heir denounced as a murderer, the estate had reverted to the crown, nor had the accused man made any attempt to exculpate himself or regain his property. Shaken by some horror greater than that of conscience or the law, and expressing only a frantic wish to exclude the ancient edifice from his sight and memory, Walter de la Poore, 11th Baron Exham, fled to Virginia, and there founded the family which by the next century had become known as de la Poore. Exham Priory had remained untenanted, though later allotted to the estates of the Norris family and much studied because of its peculiarly composite architecture, an architecture involving Gothic towers resting on a Saxon or Romanesque substructure, whose foundation in turn was of a still earlier order or blend of orders, Roman and even Druidic or native Cymric, if legends speak truly. This foundation was a very singular thing, being merged on one side with the solid limestone of the precipice from whose brink the priory overlooked a desolate valley 3 miles west of the village of Anchester. Architects and antiquarians loved to examine this strange relic of forgotten centuries, but the country folk hated it. They had hated it hundreds of years before, when my ancestors lived there, and they hated it now, with the moss and mold of abandonment on it. I had not been a day in Anchester before I knew I came of an accursed house. And this week, workmen have blown up Exham Priory and are busy obliterating the traces of its foundations.
Hey, did you know that H.P. Lovecraft had some issues with race?
What?
Say no. What? Yeah. Guy had some hang-ups.
Maybe just a few.
I would think that, okay, so what's funny is if you look this story up on tvtropes.com, mm-hmm. And I always go to tvtropes.com for these stories because there's usually like a few like things I didn't notice that people point out.
Yeah.
But everyone points at, like, there's this thing where, like, people are just like, no one can talk about this story without bringing up the name of the cat. And I'm like, yeah, because it's a horrible name, and he uses it, like,
60 times.
In the story. Like,
yeah.
So many times. I was going to do, like, a search for how many times he uses it, but then I was like, I don't know if I want that in my search history.
I mean, we could just count.
No, I'm going to search it. I'm going to search it right now.
How many times is the name of the cat said in Rats in the Walls?
I'm going to have to be very specific, though, and not just use the first part of the cat's name, because otherwise it'll show up in other things in this collection. So it looks like he uses it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19 times in the story, he says it.
And the story is like 14 pages.
The story is short. The cat's name is mentioned in places where he didn't even have to say the cat's name.
No.
But it's, and for listeners, we are not going to say the cat's name. Like,
no.
Because not only does the cat's name isn't just a racial slur. It is a racial slur that has been added to a hyphen and the word man and somehow made even worse.
Mm-hmm. Also, the story is 13 pages long.
Also, it was the name of his actual cat when he was a kid, which just goes to show you that he was always terrible.
Yep.
Now, we've discussed H.P. Lovecraft already on this show.
A few times, yeah.
Yeah. Terrible man, but gave birth to a new type of horror. And you know, say what you will about him, he was a terrible man.
He was a terrible man.
But he mostly kept to himself, and this was before Twitter, so...
Yeah, he was a terrible man who other terrible men were like, dude, you need to not.
Yeah, this is bad even for the olden days, which are today. Yes. Yeah, so he writes this story, The Rats in the Walls, in August and September of 1923. It doesn't get published until 1924 in Weird Tales, although he had tried to sell it to several like magazines. He said that he was looking at the wallpaper late at night and there were cracks in it. And he just started imagining like what was behind the cracks in the walls. And in his commonplace book, he mentions horrible secret in crypt of ancient castle discovered by dweller. And you can kind of put those two ideas together and you kind of get the rats in the walls, even though there's most likely no actual rats in the walls in this story. Let's see. And then he tries selling it and nobody wants it until he finally sells it to Weird Tales in 1924. And it becomes one of his more popular stories. And despite the wonky, as you will bring up, the wonky mythology in the tale, and despite the blatant racism in the cat's name, it's an I think it's an interesting story.
Yeah.
And I get why it's in The Medusa in the Shield, part of The Dark Descent, which is what we're discussing because I am Phil.
And I'm Willow.
And it's Del Toro time. It's Del Toro time. And we're talking about The Medusa in the Shield, which is about psychological horror. And this story might, in fact, be entirely psychological.
Yeah.
Except
also,
for the places where
reading it will cause people psychological anguish.
So The Rats in the Walls, what is this story about?
A story is about a man who has lost his son in the war, and he's rebuilding his family's old, estate, his family from a long time ago. And his family has some rumors about it, that they're evil demon worshipping cultists or something.
Yeah.
The estate was left abandoned after one of the members of the family killed everybody, supposedly. And then a bunch of stuff starts happening to him, and they find some creepy stuff. And then it ends with him being locked up in a asylum.
It does. It's one of the few Lovecraft stories that actually does end with the main character locked. Like, that's like considered a Lovecraft trope, is that like, the main character goes mad and ends up in an asylum. This is one of the ones where that really happens. And
yeah.
He goes bazonkers, eats a dude, and blames the rats. So why is it called The Rats in the Walls? This is the second of our The Walls trilogy.
Yep. It's called The Rats in the Walls because he keeps hearing rats in the walls.
Yeah. But are
only
there...
he can hear them.
Do the cats hear the rats?
The cats hear something.
Yeah. But the people don't hear the rats.
No.
Yeah.
And to be fair, it's a bunch of cats that he just moved to a new place. And, you know, cats tend to not really like that very much.
And cats tend to be irrational anyway. We don't ever know what they're doing. But he has a cat, his favorite cat, which is his boyhood cat. A cat which has been whose name has been changed in some collections, actually, to Black Tom. Which makes sense. It's Tomcat and it is black. So if we have to refer to the cat, I guess Black...
Can we come up with a different name?
How about Alan?
Yeah, Alan the cat.
So Alan is his cat. And name aside, Alan is a pretty cool character.
Alan is a good cat.
Yeah, he's a main character in the story. Like, as horrible as the man was, H.P. Lovecraft loved cats. He loved cats. He thought they were the greatest animal. He wrote stories about the cats. Cats of Ulthar is just about how awesome cats are. The cats can go to the moon. The cats can protect you from evil. He loves his cats. And so it doesn't surprise me that he finally just gave a cat a prominent role in a story.
Yeah.
He just had to give it an unfortunate name. So my favorite part of this story is all the sort of hinted at history of the Delaporte family. They were so awful that like children's rhymes were made up about like various members over the hundreds of years they lived in this area. Exham Priory in England is where they are. And our narrator, it's first person narrated. We never learn his name. We just know that his last name is Delaporte. And you mentioned that the last person to live in the castle who was a Delaporte killed the rest of the family. And he fled to America, but he didn't flee to America because everyone around him was like, good job. Good job. Thanks. And like the church was like, you did good, sir. And they gave him like a hero's exit as he went off to America.
Yeah. Which, you know what? Given what we learn about the family, we don't even know if he killed the family, though. He was just suspected of killing the family.
Well, yeah, they disappeared. So,
yeah.
You know, what are you going to do? But that's not the first time someone kills members of this family and everyone's just like, good job. Good job. Mm-hmm. Like, you hear a couple of stories about that. I just love the way he just sort of drops hints about like the complete nastiness of these people.
Yeah.
But they weren't the original. They didn't start the bad stuff that happened on this plot of land.
No.
It's directly tied into actual Roman mythology. Encyclopedic Roman mythology. It's amazing that this is exactly what the Romans were like with their goddesses.
So here's the thing. he has taken two gods, Cybele and Attis. Mm. And they were not originally Roman gods. They weren't even originally Greek gods. They were Phrygian gods. Cybele was the mother of the gods. And eventually in Rome, she was sort of tied in with Rhea, their mother of the gods. But she wasn't a dark goddess by any means. And she was never banned in Rome. They worshipped her. They brought her in annually. They had a ceremony for her. Some of the stuff that her like priests did was a little messed up.
But what priests weren't?
The Gallic priests, they did self-castration, which ties into the myth of her and Attis. She drove Attis to madness for his infidelity, and he castrated himself. So she was by no means a dark, mysterious, unknown goddess, as she is labeled in this. They're technically called the cult of Cybele, but every god had a cult because cult right. meant something different. But she was in Greece. She was tied in with Dionysus. There were orgies and stuff, like orgy celebrations that eventually tied in with the orgies of Dionysus. She was just the goddess of fertility. In Rome, she's the goddess of other things in Rome as well, but goddess of like fertility and motherhood and things like that. I read a paper, because of course I did, about how one person wrote a paper about how their theory is that she became widely worshipped in Rome because of all the lead poisoning causing infertility issues, which I thought was interesting. But yeah, no, she was never a secret underground demon goddess.
Right. So he takes some, would you say, liberties with...
I'd say he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Now, just because that wasn't what really happened doesn't mean that some people in the unknown world treated her like that. Like, maybe this was never recorded. I think he just wanted to be able to use the expression magna mater. I think he just wanted to be able to have characters yell that out.
Yeah.
Because they do a lot. Like, that phrase comes up.
Magna mater. It's just bad. I don't like it.
Yeah. So he takes a lot of liberties with... He does that throughout. It's kind of a... I believe he's following in the traditions of Lord Dunsany, who kind of did that. Was like, I'll take these established gods who most readers don't know a ton about, and I'll kind of twist them. He did it with... Dagon, god Dagon. In Cthulhu mythos, the god Dagon is not really what the actual god Dagon was. So,
I just felt like it was necessary to give some context because a lot of people probably aren't going to read a lot about Cybele, and I don't want their entire perception of the goddess based off of this story.
Yeah. It's funny that, like, because you were like, I'm so mad at this story, and I thought you were going to be like, I don't know what, the last thing I thought was that because he got the mythology so awfully
wrong. Obviously, the racism is awful, and that's really upsetting. But everyone knows that the racism is awful, and that's really upsetting.
Someone else points out that he says, I saw my old black cat dart past me like a winged Egyptian god. And they're like, Isis was sometimes depicted as winged, but Bast, which is the cat or lion god, didn't have wings. So they're like, I don't know which one he was referring to at this point.
Yeah.
But he also mentions Nyarlathotep at one point, and that's just like, what? He says, Nyarlathotep, the mad faceless god, howls blindly in the darkness to the piping of two amorphous idiot flute players. And I'm like, well, that's Azathoth. That's not even Nyarlathotep. So he gets his own mythology wrong.
Yeah.
It could be. You know what it could be?
What?
Unreliable narrator. Maybe it's just the narrator doesn't know anything about mythology.
I don't think so.
So speaking of unreliable narrator, though, this guy is probably one of the most unreliable Lovecraft narrators of all time, considering he doesn't even really realize he ate his friend.
Yeah.
So
did
what
you
are
know
they?
That Sybil has a cart that's pulled by two lions.
Ooh,
it's pretty
fancy,
cool.
Like the Wizard of Oz lady, Ozma. Her cart is pulled by the Cowardly Lion and the Hungry Tiger.
Yeah.
So you know. He wants to eat a fat baby. The story is fairly simple. The first chunk is all about the history of this guy's family.
Mm-hmm.
And the second part is him rebuilding this castle. So he's actually rebuilding it. So it has like modern conveniences, but it looks like the original castle.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got plumbing. It's got electric lights. He's trying to turn it into like a, basically like a tourist spot.
Yeah.
Like, for people to come and stay. And I'm going to go out. I'm going to admit something right now. The narrator of Rats in the Walls is, and this might not be a popular opinion, but the narrator of Rats in the Walls is one of my favorite Lovecraft protagonists.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's one of the most just like down to earth. Like, even though he goes insane and he's racist, he just seems like a guy. Like,
yeah.
He
loved his son, and he took care of his son for 2 years, and then his son died, and it's just a shame he's horrifically racist.
He's horrifically racist because of his terrible cat, or his great cat with a terrible name.
Yeah, and the way that he describes all of the bones and things.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, okay, I'll give him the bones because that's just him, like, that's anthropology in 1920, whatever. Like, he mentions the Piltdown Man. This is written before the Piltdown Man was revealed to be a hoax. So there's some questionable anthropology going on in this one.
Hey, to be fair, most anthropology and archaeology early on was pretty bad.
Yeah.
Stealing corpses from indigenous people.
I was gonna say they were. I believe they were still eating mummies at this point.
Yeah.
Let's
not forget the origins of archaeology, everybody.
Right, and Lovecraft was going off the books that he had available to him. But this story does make clear that Lovecraft did research. Like he was well read. Like he knew the names. He had. He knew what he was talking about to a greater or lesser degree. But he starts hearing these rats behind the walls, which is weird because he thought the walls were solid stone. So he's friends with this guy.
His son was friends with this guy.
Right. He's a friend of his late son named Captain Norris.
Mm-hmm. I like Captain Norris.
I do too. He's kind of a round faced. He's like a kind of a roly poly. Yeah, roly poly little guy. But they do the math, and I think the narrator, just if you do the math of how many years have gone by, he's like in his 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So he's friends with this young guy, and they go exploring underneath. He hears the rats go underneath the castle, and he discovers that there is a secret sub basement, basically.
Yeah.
And initially they just find like carvings and inscriptions that hint at weird things, and they get a group of experts, including like a man who's unfortunately psychic, to go.
Unfortunately, psychic is a good way to describe this.
And it's kind of cool that like it has the like let's gather together the investigation team. Like this is a role playing game. Like this is a Call of Cthulhu campaign, and
yep.
They're getting everybody together to go investigate the ruins, and they make a horrible discovery underneath the castle.
A horrible but really awesome discovery.
And what is that horrible discovery?
It's like a subterranean, like, living space.
Uh-huh.
Like a city.
But what were they doing in the city?
Dying.
But who was dying?
The peasantry, I think they call them. And rats.
Well, you're leaving out the most horrific part. Which is that there's cages down there in which they were breeding people as cattle.
Yep.
And the people had been being bred for so long, they had evolved into walking on all fours. And they find it's funny because it's almost like a shopping mall.
Yeah.
Down there, it's like this subterranean, like there's a big hallway and there's like different shops off to the side. And they find like each place represents like a different era. Like, oh, here's the British one. And they go into like this British butchery and they're like, he doesn't go in, but Norris does. And he comes out and he's like, because there's like,
yeah, there's one archaeologist, Walter something, I think is his name.
Uh-huh.
Who's just unfazed throughout this entire thing when everyone else is.
Yeah, yeah. Because he's like he's your traditional strapping hero.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't get much of a part because he's not interesting.
He is fully named, though.
Yeah. There's Hoffman. There's Dr. Trask, who's the anthropologist.
Mm-hmm.
There is Sir William Brinton.
Yeah, I think that's the one I'm thinking of.
Yeah, they're all very, like, hoity-toity names.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Captain Norris, Sir William Brinton, who is famous for his excavations in the Troad.
He kept reading it as Toad.
What?
Kept reading it as Toad.
His Toad, yep. And they find out that whoever was living underground was breeding humans for livestock and for sacrifices. Because they find this altar at one point that's obviously had human sacrifice committed on top of it. And they're like, there's something under the altar because there's air blowing out of it. And they sort of describe this like weird counterweight system that you have to do to like get the altar to move. And then underneath that is a deeper chamber. At one point, though, they come across an even darker, deeper chamber and they just nope out of it. I love that. They're like,
yeah,
we just decided we're not even going to go that far.
Because they find the chamber before, that's the thing that leads into the big underground place.
Yeah, yeah.
And within this big underground place, there are a bunch of rat bones as well as human bones, because the rats all started starving, so they came out and, like, swarmed the people and killed them.
And so, like, yeah, there's these pits, or these, like, bins that people must have been in. And they would put them in there with the rats, and the rats would eat the people. Like, it just sounds horrible. Which is, you know, the way it's supposed to seem.
Yeah. So this is the part of the story that definitely happened, though, right?
Right. Him going down there with these men and finding all this horrible stuff. At least, because he's an unreliable narrator. I don't know how much of what he believed he saw was true, but one guy does go insane. The psychic guy goes insane.
Supposedly. We don't actually have any proof of that. He just says he's not allowed to see him.
Oh, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Because what ends up happening is that he gets, like, the lights go out.
He, like, goes ahead. The rats are, like, leading him ahead or something, and he sees something.
Yeah.
He sees, like, Norris's face on something or whatever.
So he's been, because he's been having nightmares about a swine herd. And one of the, the cattle, the swine herd is driving, have Norris's face. And in his mind, he starts putting together in his mind that Norris's family were descendants of the people who were trapped underground.
Yeah.
And that his family were the swineherds.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, this is just a nightmare of a guy who might be mentally ill.
And also might slightly blame Norris for his son's death.
Yes. So yeah. That's the big thing at the end, the twist. And one of the reasons I really like this story.
Yeah.
Because he says his foot slips in the dark and he thinks he's going to fall into a pit. It says, I couldn't see any of the party but the plump Captain Norris. There came a sound from that inky, boundless, farther distance that I thought I knew, and I saw my old black cat dart past me like a winged Egyptian god straight for the illimitable gulf of the unknown. And that's when he starts hearing like eldritch horrors, and he thinks he imagines Nyarlathotep. And then he hears voices and yowls, gently rising as a stiff, bloated corpse rises gently above an oily river that flows under endless onyx bridges to the black putrid sea. Something bumped into me. It must have been the rat. Something soft and plump. And he starts yelling and shrieking, but he says, I am not that demon swineherd in the twilight grotto. It was not Edward Norris's fat face on that flabby fungus thing. Who says I am a Delapore? He lived, but my boy died. Shall a Norris hold the lands of a Delapore? And then he starts like freaking out. And when they find him, he's eating Norris.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, this is about a guy who's gone mad from grief. And it's kind of like using this weird mythology as like a conduit for that.
Yeah. Because his son was interested in the lore of the family. And would write him letters about the family lore. And Norris was the one who got his son information about the family.
Right.
So did it all sort of ties together as a mess of enabling history.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's one of the reasons that this is one of the ones where I'm just like, yeah, I can see why you put this in the psychological horror section. Because it's just, I mean, as far as we know, nothing supernatural ended up happening.
Yeah.
I mean, there were people maybe being bred for food underground, but that's not supernatural.
That's just awful.
It's terrible. Of course, there's no way that people could have evolved that quickly into...
No.
Yeah, but...
Although they may not have evolved, they may have devolved, as it would be. Because when put in situations where they're not given food,
right,
education, water, normal socializing, humans are just animals like everything else.
Right.
Also, there's no way in hell that was happening for 10,000 years, as he says at one point.
Right. Because he believes that this place was, it had druid temples, it had prehistoric temples. It had druid temples, it had Roman temples. Like, you sort of get the idea that he believes that the land itself is kind of cursed. Like, it's just a place that's drawn horrible, and that the Delapore family was just the latest part of all that.
Yeah.
Or there's something living underground that's even worse than the rats that they're sacrificing people to. It never goes any further than that.
Yeah. There's something else in that pit that they didn't go down.
Something else, yeah.
Yeah. He makes it clear at the beginning of the story that the place is being torn down now. He says like a couple lines or a couple paragraphs, like, now the building is being torn down and here's why.
Right. And yeah, and it's mostly a self-contained story. Like I said, he mentions Nyarlathotep, but it's a kind of a different character. I think this is the first story he ever included that name in. There was a poem about Nyarlathotep, but this is not the same guy. The Magna Mater and Cybele have been folded into the Cthulhu mythos, like this version of all that.
Cybele.
Exum Priory is mentioned. Bolton, Massachusetts.
So I call you Cybele. That's my bad.
Was mentioned in Reanimator and Color Out of Space. And Lady Margaret Trevor of Cornwall, which is the woman who had the terrible poems made up about her, is apparently, it says, a direct ancestor of the narrator of the Lovecraft story Caliphias, who was the narrator was the last of a noble family that lived in an ancestral manor for 13 generations at the coast on the other side of the Surrey Downs from London, mm-hmm. and perishes by drowning at the foot of a sea cliff below the ancestral home, which is named Trevor Towers. So it could have been that these families were all connected. Yeah. So yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting that like he may have accidentally maybe connected this to his other writings. Yeah. But so that's yeah.
The cat does a good job in the story.
The cat does a good job in the story.
Alan the cat.
Alan. We like Alan. But yeah, I like the Rats in the Walls for what it is, and think that maybe as far as I know, no one's ever done like a Kingfisher-esque rewrite of it. Like a mm-hmm. let's do a retelling of Rats in the Walls. Maybe someone has. If anyone knows of a rewrite of this, I would love to like read like an expanded novel mm-hmm. of it. But there have been comic books. I read a comic book adaptation of this illustrated by Richard Corbin. H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society did a radio drama of it.
Did they change the cat's name?
I don't know if they changed the cat's name. I don't know. I haven't listened to it. But there have been a bunch of audio adaptations and readings and not really any movies, but it's a short story that's lived on past, maybe past its sell-by date, but who knows?
Who knows? Yeah, I mean, it's a really good story. It's just really racist.
Yeah, it's just racist. It's not his most racist.
It's just racist. Sorry. It's a good story. Great writing. Great, like telling. It is horrifically racist. But, so if that's not something that you're comfortable reading, and if that's something that makes stories bad for you, then yes, that it's a bad story.
I will say that it is very racist, but it's certainly not his most racist.
It's just saying something.
Because the horror at Red Hook still exists. And oh boy. And also, he doesn't encounter any people of color in this story, which is for the best.
Mm-hmm.
H.P. Lovecraft, everyone. The man that we have to deal with. So, yeah, I'm looking at this comic book adaptation of Rats in the Walls, and it's Richard Corbin, so it goes a little over the top at times. But it's fun. And so if you want to get your hands on that, you can find it in several Richard Corbin collections. But I don't have anything else to add about this.
Yeah.
It's the Rats in the Walls.
Just a solid story.
Just a story.
Yeah.
I can imagine it being adapted in some way for like an episode of Cabinet of Curiosities.
They already did the rat episode.
But this one seems like it's just sitting there waiting for that.
Yeah.
Like it's just like someone should, some kind of expansion of the backstory is what I want.
If they change, if they decide to do this for season two of Cabinet of Curiosities, please make the cat's name Alan.
The cat will be named Alan. Oh, and Stephen King wrote a homage to this story.
I've read that one.
Jerusalem's yep. Lot, which isn't exactly like this, but mm-hmm. it does involve it. It's a Lovecraft pastiche anyway.
Yeah,
and it does involve rats in the walls.
And very similar town reaction to the main character.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's about a guy who inherits a house and goes to live in it, but it's in Jerusalem's Lot, which of course. Yeah. is also known as Salem's Lot, which is mm-hmm. the town the vampires end up coming to. That's a good story.
It is
That's a good story. There's a moment in that short story when I first read it when I was in junior high that made me yell. It scared me so much. It was the first time I'd ever yelled out loud while reading a horror story or a story of any kind. I went, ha!
Why?
Yeah. There's a moment where he turns around and he sees like a ghost, like a hanging corpse.
Mm-hmm.
And it just shocked me. Like I was not expecting it. It gave me it was literally a literary jump scare. And so, yeah, highly recommended.
Yeah, I have a book with it in it.
What is that? Is that Night Shift or Grave?
Night Shift.
It's a Night Shift? Okay. Yeah, I have my copy of... I have a copy of Night Shift sitting right over here. So,
is that my copy of it? I don't know if it's back here.
No, this is a new copy that I just bought recently.
Okay.
I'm not going to steal your copy.
Well, I might have left it at your house when I moved out.
No. No, because I looked desperately for a copy of...
Yeah.
Of Graveyard Shift.
It should just be behind me somewhere.
Night Shift. So, yeah. So, that's The Rats in the Walls by H.P. Lovecraft. It's good. It's in the Dark Descent. What's next?
Shalgen the Painter by J. Sheridan Le Fanu.
Oh, I'm sorry. What?
Shalgen the Painter.
It's Shalk. I am not looking at it. So
Shalgen.
Shalgen.
Yeah, it's S C H A L K E N.
Shalgen.
Shalgen the Painter. By Le Fanu.
I've never heard of this story.
Neither have I. I've heard of Le Fanu, though.
Yes, I believe. Did we read a Sheridan Le Fanu story already? Yes, we read Mr. Justice Harbottle.
Right. Oh, and this one is, we were talking about why they separated the yellow wallpaper from the other wall stories. And apparently this one is a direct ancestor of the yellow wallpaper.
Well, then this has gotten even more interesting. Ladies and gentlemen... The celebration of walls in horror will continue with the direct ancestor of the yellow wallpaper. What
Shalgen
did you call
the painter?
Shalgen the painter. We will see if this guy shalks the shalk.
Shalks the paint.
So until next time, when we shalk along with Shalgen the painter. I'm Phil.
And I'm Willow.
And we'll see you when
it's Del Toro time.
Come on.